You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up.
Aquí está.
Here it is. This is the litmus test for the international community. It has been made clear what we are willing to do to continue on the electoral path. There are no more excuses.
Venezuela's opposition presidential candidate Maria Machado names a substitute while she fights a government ban on her running for office as political repression by the regime continues. We'll have the latest. Also ahead, we'll ask why cargo ships have grown so big in the last decade. Then,
culture and amenities and great food, great places to work, great connectivity, all of those things create the vibrancy and bring people together. I'm a great believer in people attract people.
Advice on how to bring life back to our downtowns. Also, from embroidered pillowcases to gold-plated plates, the White House says it's had enough of journalists nicking stuff from Air Force One. We'll ask, what's the worst thing you've ever stolen? That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. A suspected Israeli airstrike has destroyed an Iranian consulate building in the Syrian capital Damascus, killing the top two commanders in the powerful Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets of Jerusalem for a third day of protest against the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And Microsoft says it is to split the messaging and video service Teams from its Office software. It follows the threat of a fine from competition watchdogs. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, what chances are there of freedom or fairness holding significance in this year's elections in Venezuela? The opposition is now fielding a third candidate to take on the incumbent President Nicolas Maduro. The first two encountered insurmountable obstacles in their attempts to get on the ballot paper. And then yesterday, a popular Venezuelan YouTuber was arrested in Caracas on terrorism charges. Oscar Alejandro Perez was detained just as he was about to fly to Canaima National Park. Well, I'm joined now to assess the situation by Christopher Sabatini, Senior Fellow for Latin America at Chatham House. It's been operating a long-running project on negotiations, human rights and economic prosperity in Venezuela, with a specific focus on supporting the conditions for internationally accepted free and fair elections in the planned 2024 presidential elections and the 2025 parliamentary elections. He also happens to be a regular voice around the microphone. Hello, good morning, Christopher.
Good morning, Emma. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, let's just look straight ahead to July the 28th, which is the expected day of these elections in Venezuela. Where are we in terms of who might or might not be on the ballot paper?
So the period when candidates could register has ended. That was March 25th last week. And basically, you have about 10 candidates. Some of these are shill candidates put up by the government of Maduro to try to split the vote, distract voters and the like. The big issue is basically two opposition candidates. The one which you mentioned is Maria Corina Machado, who won a primary in November of informally organized primary among the opposition with a good solid vote of about 2 million to 3 million votes. And she was really the anointed candidate of the opposition, of a unified opposition. But in December of last year, the government reiterated its rule that she could not hold public office, so she's effectively disqualified. She continued campaigning, but then just about a week before the March 25th deadline, appointed someone to run in her place, a woman by the name of Corina Yores. And she was an 80-year-old grandmother, sort of inoffensive, was a philosophy professor. And when it came time to inscribe Corina Yores in as an opposition candidate, the system wouldn't allow her in. So effectively, Maria Corina Machado and her alternate had been banned. At the last minute, what they did was they managed to get one placeholder, a little-known former ambassador, Edmundo Gonzalez, who's holding the place for the opposition, but we don't know who's going to run, if he's going to be the candidate, whatever. So the opposition's effectively been locked out of its preferred candidates.
And this should not be the case, should it? Because last October, Nicolas Maduro and the main opposition signed an agreement which pledged that the elections would be fairly competitive.
Exactly. This was October 17th, and there's a series of commitments that have become known as a Barbados Agreement, where the government agreed with the opposition to allow for free and fair elections, to allow candidates to be able to run freely. It did not guarantee that Maria Corina Machado and the other banned candidates, as the two others, would be reinstated, but it did guarantee a process in which they could be considered to be reinstated. But then it just ran it through their kangaroo courts, who confirmed the earlier government ruling. So, yes, they're in violation of the Barbados Agreement. But importantly, too, the U.S. had lifted sanctions, some sanctions temporarily on the country to reward it for its Barbados agreements. And now it's clearly emptied those out and violated them. So the question is now on October 18th, which is the deadline, is if the U.S. will reimpose sanctions to punish the Maduro government for violating its commitments.
Because this lifting of sanctions is intended to do what? It was allowing investment in Venezuela's energy sector, which gives the international community leverage, and it gives Venezuela, all importantly, a major injection of cash. But for Venezuela, or indeed for Nicolas Maduro's authorities to go against that, I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. And to frame it a little bit, is the Trump administration in 2019 applied what it called maximum pressure sanctions that were intended to cripple the economy, which is already crippled by the malfeasance of the government, by restricting oil sales and oil investment. And oil exports account for 95% of Venezuelan exports. So you hit the oil sector, oil's all important in Venezuela, and you cripple the economy, and nothing happened. The government didn't collapse. There are no improvements in human rights. So the Biden administration in October last year tried to leverage the sanctions by lightening them somewhat in the oil sector, allowing for investment, particularly European investment, and allowing for the sale, the legitimate sale of Venezuelan oil on global markets. The thought was that would be provide enough of an incentive for the Venezuelan government to follow its own commitments, but it wasn't. And clearly, and the government's even said this, they're much happier with sanctions and having non-competitive elections and staying in power than they are with having a flow of steady income and having the country live better.
So what does this mean in the wider context of the United States and indeed the international community's amount of leverage that it does have over Venezuela?
This is really the question of the time right now. The United States has more than 9,000 sanctions on individuals, countries, companies, sectors of the economy. And it's really unclear. It's become quite sanctions happy in terms of applying them, but not really considering the consequences and how you unwind them and use them effectively. Very often, sanctions applied quickly and for very broad and ill-defined objectives simply don't meet their goals. The question is then, what can you do in terms of lifting them without making the applier, the United States, although the European Union and the UK also apply personal sanctions in the case of Venezuela, what can you do to lift these sanctions or use them more effectively without making the applier look weak? And that's the problem right now the United States faces.
In the meantime, let's return our focus back to what exactly is happening in Venezuela. While the Venezuelan authorities and Nicolas Maduro are fielding threats and promises from the outside world, the situation in Venezuela under Maduro has really rather collapsed. Am I right in thinking that a quarter of the population has left?
Yes, 7.7 million people have left Venezuela. Most of them have taken up residence in neighboring countries, but it's become a huge electoral problem for President Biden in the United States. They're more than half a million have crossed recently. Most of them actually are taking up residence in New York City or the shelters. I was just in New York City 2 weeks ago. The shelters are taken up with Venezuelan migrants. The economy in Venezuela is a disaster. More than 80% are living in poverty. Malnutrition is rampant. It is really in economic dire straits right now.
And if you are, if you're living in Colombia or Peru or Chile, Colombia has taken what 1.7 million people in. What effect does that have on the wider region?
Yeah, it's become a real stress for a number of reasons. The first is, as you mentioned or imply, resettling and integrating these migrants, and many will probably not return, certainly anytime soon, to Venezuela, is going to put a huge strain on social services, education, healthcare, not to mention employment. So they're already We're already beginning to see some backlashes. There are some attacks against Venezuelan migrants in Chile. There are arguments that the Venezuelan basically transnational criminal organization, the Tren del Agua, has really taken up operations in human trafficking and narcotics trafficking across the region. So this is creating a huge security problem, even a huge sort of nationalist issue, as well as creating strains on already strained public services and economies.
Tell us a little bit more, therefore, about what's going to happen on April the 18th. This is when there is a renewal of the sanctions and the lifting thereof. What do you think should be done then?
I think there has to be some price to be paid for the Maduro government flagrantly thumbing its nose at the international community at its own commitments, which it made, by the way, in the presence of EU diplomats, UK diplomats, Canadian and US and Colombian diplomats. This is an agreement not that was negotiated ad hoc with the opposition. It was done with international mediators. I think there has to be some price, as I mentioned. That in a full what they call snapback sanctions really risk a more aggressive reaction by the government. They have already arrested a number of the opposition leaders. There are five right now that are in hiding right now because of the arrest warrants on their head. And you mentioned the arrest of the YouTuber. This will allow it will remove any form of leverage if the U.S. government snaps back all sanctions. But I think there has to be some price. I think what we'll see is a limiting of the ability of Venezuela to sell oil on the international markets and get cash for that. But instead, those profits would go to paying off Venezuelan debt. So there'll be a partial snapback that will hurt the Venezuelan economy, in particular the government, but not a full snapback, because quite frankly, I don't think the Biden administration wants to go back to what was a failed policy.
Chris, just briefly, I mean, you've got this long-standing project with Chatham House, which is working on negotiations and election rights and things like that. How much progress do you see as possible with a country which, first and foremost, doesn't seem to be that bothered about US sanctions, investment in the energy section, but also the International Criminal Court is looking into human rights abuses in Venezuela? These are the great bastions of the great global stopgaps, and they don't seem to be affecting or having any effect on Venezuela at all.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't want to oversell the issue of Venezuela on a global stage, but I do think it's a bellwether for the problems that the international liberal community is going to have of governments that form alliances. Russia, China, Iran all work very closely with Venezuela. They support it. And as a result, what I think we're seeing is sort of the ineffectiveness of the liberal architecture to affect a policy change in human rights in a country in which the government, quite frankly, doesn't want to leave. If free and fair elections were held in Venezuela today, the incumbent government and the incumbent president, Maduro, would clearly lose. His popularity is below 20%. In a recent survey, he only received 5% of the vote compared to 70% for Maria Corina Machado. These people are facing a severe loss of power, but also with that comes the threat of jail sanctions under the ICC, as well as other international sanctions that have been placed on them. So there's no incentive for them to step down right now, let's put it.
Christopher Sabatini, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle Radio with me, Emma Nelson. Now, Portugal's new prime minister takes office today. The centre-right former lawyer and veteran politician Luís Montenegro inherits a political landscape dominated since 2015 by the Socialist Party's António Costa. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by the British-Portuguese journalist Joana Ramiro. A very good morning to you, Joana.
Good morning. Hello.
This is a very important change of the guard, isn't it?
It does. And I would suggest that it feels a little bit beyond what would, sort of to be expected from an opposition gaining power after a long period of, a certain party being in place. Luís Montenegro's government, and it was announced, all its ministries and all its ministers last week, takes power today. And it's I would have said profoundly more conservative than one would have perhaps expected at first, given that this is also the person who throughout the electoral campaign has rejected any idea of making any alliances or coalitions with the far right, currently the third biggest party called Chega. So it's almost undoubtedly the case that they will be rolling back, this new government, this new administration will be rolling back on some of its predecessors' work, and has said potentially more so than it would be traditionally expected from any opposition gaining power.
Tell us a little bit about how the government is being made up now, because Luis Montenegro is not a prime minister with a comfortable majority, is he?
That's true. They took power with only a minority government. It's not even some sort of, you know, confidence and supply agreement with parties to its right or to the center. He has literally come to power with a minority government. It's not unheard of in Portuguese history, but it is, of course, very precarious. So what you will have throughout his tenure is a constant pressure, both from the traditional opposition, in this case, the outgoing Socialist Party, but also from us, and as I already referred to, the third largest force in parliament, and that is Chega, the far-right populist party led by André Ventura. And in particular, in this point, I think, and given the elements that Montenegro has in his administration as part of his ministers and members of staff and advisors, it'd be interesting to see where it goes, because it's already quite within the space of the right. Is he trying to gain some space out of the far right's rhetoric and political dynamic, or is it just a coincidence, but then potentially far more likely to be under the thumb and under the pressure and the sort of lobbying from the far right remains, of course, to be seen. I think it wouldn't be amiss to perhaps make comparisons to what happened with within the UK, actually, in with the Conservatives here, where you had UKIP, right, during Brexit, and the years that followed, the Conservative Party and its ministers and its secretaries have then taken a lot of that rhetoric on board, especially when it comes to immigration, of course, as we see with the last two home secretaries. So perhaps something like that could be in the horizon.
Which, when you look at Portugal over the last 10 years or so, has enjoyed comparative stability, and it emerged from the financial crisis in 2008 as one of the great survivors. It sort of pulled its own socks up and got on with it. And to all intents and purposes, it's been seen as a sort of quiet, stable place within Europe. How much does this now change?
Well, that is a big question. From an economic perspective, one would think things shouldn't change too much. And in fact, Montenegro inherits a really quite comfy position since data for the budgetary surplus of last year's just came out last week at the end of the week, and it's about 1.2% of GDP for last year. So that's a very cool 3.19 billion euros room for maneuver, which for, again, as you mentioned, one of those southern European countries, the once called pigs during the austerity period in Europe, is extremely positive, extremely good. So let's see what the Conservative administration will want to do with that, and if they can continue. As far as politically is concerned, perhaps that's not so much the case in the last 10 years. Yes, of course, we have seen fewer protests, fewer upheavals than we have seen in, let's say, Greece, for instance, or even neighborly Spain. Fewer, you know, there have been protests, but perhaps, you know, they were shorter lived and less impactful on parliamentary politics in the long run. That said, there have been growing and unmet discontents across the population, rising cost of living, rising cost in housing, quite disproportionate to people's wages, for instance. So those things have been bubbling beneath the surface. And of course, they found some echo then in the votes on the 10th of March in parties like Chega, of course, but also across the board, because the big losers of the night were, ironically, both the Conservatives that are coming into power, but as said, with a very precarious minority, but also, of course, the Socialist Party that lost a lot of their seats. So this seeming social stability, I think, was always a little bit of a mirage, and I think has been thoroughly shattered. Whether these discontents will be met now and things will calm down and maybe find some equilibrium, again, remains to be seen. I don't think that with a minority government that will be possible. So we might find ourselves back to the polls, or perhaps even seeing people going to the streets over the next 6 months.
Tell us a little bit more about Portugal's future relationship with with Europe, given the fact that a lot of the projects that Antonio Costa oversaw were financed with EU post-pandemic recovery funds. And Costa has said these must continue in order to make sure that Portugal's path remains true. We also have the four former MEPs are now coming into the government as well. So will we see Portugal taking a sort of adopting a louder voice within Europe because of the change in government?
Well, this has been one of the things talked about within this outgoing Costa government. Previously, the phrasing of the previously, you know, retired, you know, pensioner politicians would go into Europe after their tenure in Portugal. And now we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing people being almost trained or getting some, you know, more practice in Europe, becoming almost statesmen, stateswomen, and then returning and taking their seats in Parliament in Portugal, which makes for a very different dynamic inside the assembly. It's the first time we're seeing that in a sort of more hefty way, more significant and expressive way. So I am very curious to see how that then works out within the assembly's own dynamics. And again, the politics that then comes out of it. As far as Europe itself is concerned, I wouldn't be surprised if Portugal now, after, as you mentioned earlier as well, like a decade of being the good student of Europe, now would like to graduate really and start, you know, coming up as more of a louder voice coming from the southern periphery, you know, alongside the central bloc of France and Germany. It would come in the wave of a series of other Portuguese statesmen having important positions, like of course António Guterres in the UN being General Secretary. So it would be something of a thing to admire and to see Portugal taking its place within the world political stage for sure.
Joana Ramiro, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come.
We're in the process of working out how do we transform those assets, which are vital for our cities, huge stores of material and carbon as well. How do we transform that into places that are relevant for how people are using our cities now? And importantly, how we think they'll be using the cities going into the future.
We'll be rethinking the empty spaces in our cities as we hear from the managing principal for Europe, for Gensler. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
With today's newspapers, I'm delighted to say that joining me in the studio, making himself comfortable, is Charles Hecker, senior partner at Control Risks, currently on leave writing a book about Russian and international businesses. A very good morning to you, Chuck. How are you doing?
Good morning, Emma.
You have literally made a very dramatic entrance into the studio. You just dropped your phone.
Throwing my phone all over the place.
Just hit my foot. Don't worry. We'll pick it up in a minute. Right. Do you need your phone to go through the papers or should we just go for it.
Let's plow ahead.
Go. Right, what have we spotted? Welcome, by the way.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. So it's a very busy day in geopolitics. And so we'll start with the Financial Times with a headline that says, Iran accuses Israel of killing general in strike on Damascus consulate. And so we've had a very dramatic development in the conflict in the Middle East that the concerns are around that this may spark an escalation. So although Israel is remaining quiet, it is broadly accused of attacking the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria, and it killed three senior members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and everyone is holding their breath to see what comes next.
Indeed, because it was one of those moments when the news came out, I think it was at about 5 o'clock UK time yesterday, and you suddenly thought, what? This is happening in Syria, targeting Iranians, and this is Israel doing it. Now, they have done it. Israel does this quite a lot, doesn't it? But it has been ramped up an enormous amount since the 7th of October.
Right. So this is another, you know, evolving episode in the broader conflict that's behind a lot of the tension in the Middle East, and that is Iran. Iran is ideologically bent on destroying Israel. Israel has had its eyes on Iran ever more intensely as the country, as Iran, inches closer and closer to a nuclear capability. It is also widely anticipated that at some point there may be a second front in the conflict with Gaza, and that would be in Israel's north and the southern and the border with southern Lebanon, where we have Hezbollah, which is another Iran proxy. So what Israel seems to have done is sent a warning message to Iran saying, look, we're on to you. Don't mess with us. Don't open up this second front with Hezbollah, because otherwise you'll pay an even heavier price than the one we've just inflicted on you. The move now is to Iran to see how they retaliate. And so there are a series of options here, and that is that, you know, Hamas is an Iran proxy, so they could boost Hamas again in Gaza. They could boost Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, where we know that Hezbollah has missile factories. The United States has installations in Syria and in Iraq that are vulnerable to attack from Iran. And then finally, we know that Iran is a very, very good cyber combatant, and could unleash a cyber attack, either regionally or more globally.
Is there somewhere in someone in Tehran who has a cool head that could stop this from happening? Because this, I think from the moment that the conflict began in Gaza, everybody started to look at the overspill and the contagion. And this seems to be one of those moments where it could happen.
I think when it comes to this particular conflict, the answer to that question is no. That when it comes to Iran's attempt at imprinting itself as the main hegemon in the Middle East, that is sort of full speed ahead. The only indication that we have of cooler heads in Iran at all is a fairly recent thaw, although not a warming, but a thaw in relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which, of course, is the other dominant power in the region. There have been overtures between those two countries to sort of cool off their hostilities. But when it comes to Israel, Gaza and Lebanon, probably no cooling off.
Let's move to another place where things are warming up, where they should be cooling down. North Korea and the South, a definitive break in relations now, and more missiles being tested.
That's right. We're in the Japan Times now with a headline that says North Korea launches intermediate range missile as elections loom for the South. And it's precisely because North Korea has decided to test this missile in the run-up to South Korean general election on the 10th of April that South Korea was expecting this to happen. There's been a small twist, though, and that is that the intermediate range missile that North Korea has launched has a hypersonic warhead on it, or is believed to have a hypersonic warhead on it. You'll recall that this is the sort of technology that Russia has been testing lately that allows warheads to travel above the speed of sound and makes them very, very difficult to detect and very difficult to respond to in a timely fashion. What North Korea is hoping to do here is destabilize these upcoming elections, where the current president, Yoon Suk-yeol, is a strict North Korean hardliner, anti-North Korean hardliner. He faces a challenge to his parliamentary majority. He's grown very tough on the North. He's gotten even closer to the United States and is even repairing relations with Japan, all against the North. So here you have the missile test.
So how is this being covered, given the fact that missile tests are not uncommon when it comes to North Korea?
Well, that's right. So it's kind of interesting. The South was expecting this. There have been previous tests fairly recently. And the Japan Times quotes a professor at a university in Seoul that says, look, you know, we only get scared when they're doing the long range missile tests. We're not all that bothered by intermediate range missile tests. So a little bit of sang-froid in South Korea's reaction.
Let's have our sort of like a regular Donald Trump spotlight focus. We'll hear in the headlines in a moment about the fact that his Trump media company launched great fanfare last week. You could have a little slice of Trump. Not doing so well at the minute.
Emma, we could have been billionaires.
We could, but not by investing in this.
No, but exactly. So there's a very interesting development in Trump's social media holding company, which listed on the stock exchange to great fanfare last week and made him a multi-billionaire several times over. Trump's media company is what is commonly known as a meme stock, whose price has been pumped up by social media posts, and where the average punter is investing in shares, not the sophisticated sophisticated investor. And it turns out, of course, that Truth Social, Trump's media company, has just declared a $58 million loss for the quarter. And so the share price tanked.
Because it loses money and it loses users as well.
Nobody uses it. Advertisers aren't spending on it. And the market has given this company an absolutely outrageous valuation. And the market, in its infinite wisdom, has decided, you know, yesterday decided, well, maybe it's really not that valuable of a company, and just crossed off 20% of the company's value.
Let's talk finally about a really good survival story of Croydon. In southeast of London, a town which is often subject to quite a lot of criticism. It's a place that tries to get on its feet an awful lot and sort of tries to punch above its weight. Had an enormous amount of investment and then sort of large companies have left. So Croydon doesn't always have the best rep in the UK for being a sort of a major success story. But my goodness, if you check your nails and your eyebrows, you're going to be looking great there because it has a lot of beauty.
This is a story that every newspaper, every media outlet in the United Kingdom appears to be having a collective giggle about today. And we're going to go to the Times that says Britain's top beauty spot. You know, the puns are coming fast and thick already. Britain's top beauty spot. It's Kate Moss's Croydon. And the peg to all of this is recent research by an economics consultancy called Oxford Economics that says that per capita, Croydon has more workers in the beauty sector than any other town in the land. And the quick details here is that there are 203,000 employed workers in Croydon. More than 6,200 of them work in the beauty industry, including 695 hairdressers, 580 beauticians, and 95 salon owners.
It's brilliant because Croydon, going back to the 18th century, according to this article in the Times, was one of the ugliest places on earth at that time. But one does wonder. It makes you think, actually, post-pandemic, a lot of people found themselves going into the beauty industry because it was a way to make money. And it sort of is that side. That's a great survival story, isn't it? And everyone's going to be checking their nails next time they get the train to Croydon.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting. When you go to other cities, I don't know if you've noticed this, when you go to Berlin, every other storefront appears to be a hairdresser. I find that absolutely remarkable. And when you go to New York City, every other storefront appears to be a nail salon. So Croydon's finally caught on to something here. And I guess it's all the more reason to sort of hop off the train as you're normally passing through Croydon, perhaps on the way to Gatwick Airport, have a bit of a brow job or you know, a sort of touch up on the roots.
Charles Ecker, thank you. So we're looking at each other now for a while. Charles, can I describe your haircut?
Yeah.
Yeah, not much. No. possibly not needing to go to Croydon anytime soon, but very well turned out nonetheless. Charles Hecker, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. The time here in London is 7:32. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A look now at the rest of today's headlines. A suspected Israeli strike has destroyed an Iranian consulate building in the Syrian capital, Damascus, killing at least seven people, including the top two commanders in the powerful Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Iran's foreign ministry says the country's response will be decisive. Israel says it doesn't comment on foreign media reports. Thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets of Jerusalem for a third day of protest against the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, demanding new elections. The protests have gathered in intensity as the war in Gaza nears the end of its sixth month, and there's anger at the government's handling of the 134 Israeli hostages still being held by Hamas. Microsoft says it will split the messaging and video service Teams from its Office software. It follows the threat of a fine from competition watchdogs. The European Commission had received a complaint from Teams' rival, Slack. And shares of Donald Trump's social media company have fallen by more than 20% less than a week after the firm began publicly trading. Last week, shares in Trump Media and Technology surged, valuing the company at $11 billion. But experts warned the stock was bound to fall as its main product, Truth Social, loses both users and money. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, it's no secret that people are moving more and more into densely populated areas. It's estimated that more than half of the world's population now lives in cities, with that number expected to swell to around 5 billion by 2030. Well, in order to create areas that are livable, architects, planners and municipalities are hard at work making sure we design better cities for tomorrow. One of them is Gensler, the global design and architecture company, the largest architecture firm in the world. Building resilient and people-centric cities is at top of mind for the practice. And Duncan Swinhoe is the managing principal for Europe at Gensler. And earlier, he spoke with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck. Andrew began by asking Duncan about what changes he'd noticed in recent years about people, how people use their cities.
The big change that's coming out of the pandemic has been the way that we think about, the way that we set about, the way that we work. The locations we choose to do that, the time we spend to do that, and I think the choices that we now feel that we have as a workforce about how and where we work, in conjunction with the digitization of the workforce and the democratization of the workforce that has happened through the pandemic, have created a real shift in how we use and view our cities. And I think if you go around many cities in the Northern Hemisphere, there are grey areas of our sort of CBDs that are quite monofunctional in the way that they've been planned in the past, with a lot of concentration of large offices that are no longer relevant to the way that we're thinking and using our cities today. And we're in the process of working out how do we transform those assets, which are vital for our cities, huge stores of material and carbon as well. How do we transform that into places that are relevant for how people are using our cities now? And importantly, how we think they'll be using the cities going into the future. And that conversation is something that's happening here in Europe, in North America, around really the developed cities in the world.
Tell me, when you look at some of those CBDs, it's easy to identify maybe some buildings that could be converted, but actually when you get to the floor plate, sometimes they're too deep, sometimes there's a lack of infrastructure to entertain those people at the weekends when all the workers have gone and people are reluctant to pay premium for those projects. What are the problems in trying to change the way that CBDs are currently run?
The word monofunctional, I think, is at the heart of it. I think what we're seeing is that the areas that people are attracted to in cities, and you can go to New York, you can go to London, are places that have a really wide diversity of activities and activation at different times of the day. So culture and amenities and great food, great places to work, great connectivity, all of those things create the vibrancy and bring people together. Great believer in people attract people. And so if you look at the monofunctional parts of cities where they maybe have a predominance of, say, office buildings, typically built at a certain period of time, the key question is how can we transform those assets to facilitate the way that people want to use their cities, replicate to a certain extent, but also look at these areas and say, well, what are the assets that they have that could be an add to a city? Some of them have great sort of public spaces, great connectivity to infrastructure. We can see new areas of industry looking for new types of spaces, sciences and healthcare and pharma and development that actually fit quite well into buildings. And the big change that we see coming is taking the predominance of commercial office buildings and converting those into places that people can live in, people can come and spend time in hotels in, people can come for entertainment in, as well as the core function that they were first designed for, which was to do work within. That blurring of the lines between how we live and how we work is creating opportunities to unlock assets. And what we found has been a really powerful tool for this is an algorithm that we designed in Canada during the pandemic, which enabled clients with large portfolios of commercial office to very quickly and very accurately determine which of those buildings, back to your deep floor plate comment, have a higher potential of being transformable into different types of users, primarily residential. And that's now enabling owners of commercial office to start to make informed decisions about how do they change their use, how do they create future value for their buildings, but also how do we do this in a way that captures the carbon that's invested in there, reuses the materials in a really sort of smart and sophisticated way, and actually create the relevance that we see our clients, whether they be hoteliers or entertainment providers, office workers, are being attracted to. And I think that's unlocking a lot of creativity within the design sphere.
Is there any reluctance on the part of cities to see this wholesale change over to residential? Because I guess one of the other problems is, as you said, that we're still in a period of not quite clear what the direction of travel for everything post-pandemic, even though it's a few years since. In the US, you're seeing many companies now saying, look, actually, you need to come back to the office 2 days, 3 days, 4 days a week, sometimes full time. Do you think we will see an uptick in demand for good office space in the right zones are connected with entertainment and things to do when you leave the office at whatever time that is you're allowed to go home.
Yes, we've seen this in many of the key markets that you associate with work. So take London. Their vacancy rates for their prime A office space is about 1.5%. So the demand is there and the rents have been climbing actually over the last few years. So where you have really good quality product that meets the requirements of today's contemporary occupiers, which put the climate and the ESG requirements right at the top of their list, actually, we're seeing that those assets are actually in high demand and have high value. The challenge is for all of the sort of not great buildings that maybe weren't renovated last decade, that have fallen behind, that have this term that we use, stranded. They've become stranded assets. The amount of investment that's required to keep them as contemporary offices maybe doesn't align with the investor's appetite or ability, or maybe the location they're in doesn't suit the kind of tenants that they may be targeting, as people's patterns about where they choose to work has changed. And so that's where transformation of office into other types of uses becomes really, really important.
How office space gets used, the fit out of it, is actually as often as important as where the project is. Are you involved in that granular detail, saying, look, if you want to make spaces where people want to interact, if people want to use space in a different way, do you do much in the future proofing of spaces like that, helping clients reimagine what those spaces should be like?
Yes, absolutely. A significant part of what our teams focus on are occupier clients, we call them, and they range from the global technology companies that have operations around the world, the banks, the lawyers. I'll give you an example. So NVIDIA, that headquarters was designed by Gensler pre-pandemic. We've just completed phase 3 now for that building, and that's inside and outside, and it is as far away from what you would think an office building is as you could possibly imagine. It is a future environment that's designed specifically to create collaboration, you know, to bring innovators and that community together in a super effective way. And you can see the results. It's an incredible building. And just to play on the San Francisco conversation a little bit, because there's been a lot of negativity around the hollowing out of the CBD in San Francisco. It's probably one of the more acutely impacted cities in North America. Gensler's just moved into its new home in San Francisco. It's our spiritual home. It's where we were founded. And we've moved into a new building which is designed for Gensler, for creative communities to come together, collaborate and work together in the way that we see all of our people wanting to do. And interestingly, they're not in sort of one day a week or 2 days a week. They're in most of the time together, collaborating. And that's because the space facilitates that.
And that was Duncan Swinhoe from Gensler in conversation with Andrew Tuck. You're with Monocle Radio. AM in Zurich, 2:42 AM in Baltimore. Now, when the giant cargo ship Dali struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore a week ago, on board were items found in every American, if not Western, household. Furniture, ladies' vests, air conditioners, construction machinery and tins of coconut milk, among many others. The 300-metre-long cargo vessel contained a snapshot of just how much we rely on our consumer goods to be effortlessly transported around the world just to end up in our homes. Well, what the Baltimore crash also did was highlight just how huge these vessels containing our consumer goods have grown. And I'm joined now to tell us more by Elizabeth Brough, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and a columnist for Foreign Policy. A very good morning to you, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
So we're now looking, aren't we, at cargo vessels now, which are too big for any bridge to withstand impact. They're called what? Ultra-large container vessels, ULCVs. You know, how big are they?
They are huge. And we should remember that the Dali wasn't even one of the biggest vessels out there. So she is the next size down. She has a capacity of 10,000 TEU, which is huge. It's 10,000 containers. The largest vessels today have a capacity of above 20,000 TEUs and even up to almost 25,000. Imagine 25,000 containers stacked lengthwise and upwards on a vessel. And the problem is that bridges are not built as often as vessels. Bridges and other infrastructure are not built as often as new vessels. So the Key Bridge was built in 1971 when vessels were much smaller. The largest vessel back then had a capacity of less than 3,000 TEU. So that gives you an idea of how big vessels are today and the gap between vessels and the infrastructure in the rivers and ports and so forth. Coasts that these vessels use.
So the TEO, let's just be clear, is one of those 20-foot long shipping containers that we see packed onto or stacked onto the great container ships, looking tiny like little Lego bricks. But that sort of gives you a sort of sense of scale here. Where is this scale coming from? It clearly makes financial sense for the world's goods to be transported en masse on vessels like this.
It does. The shipping company is a marvel. The shipping industry is a marvel of efficiency. And because we, as you said in your introduction, depend on everything we consume on a daily basis being transported from somewhere else, shipping companies have been extremely good at making that economical so that we will continue doing it. And one way of making it economical is using ever larger ship. Another way, of course, is using employees from non-Western countries. And so we have also seen over the past few decades that the people who crew merchant vessels have become have essentially changed nationality. Today, very few people from the West go to sea, as it's called, and it's the industry is dominated by people from India, Indonesia, the Philippines, and it wasn't unusual that the Dali was crewed by 22 Indians. But the point is that it's extremely efficient to send goods on large ships that can take, as we said, up to or more than 25,000, up to 25,000 containers. And the shipping industry has been very good at ordering and getting these new ships built so that we can send all these goods. And yep.
The Dali is an example, though, of what happens when the world cannot accommodate its needs. I mean, you've already mentioned the fact that it is far bigger a ship than any of those that were constructed during the time when the Key Bridge was built. And then we just need to look back a little bit to 2021 when we had the Ever Given stuck in the Suez Canal for just a mere 6 days, causing absolute havoc to the transportation of goods around the world. And we're also looking at Houthi rebels and their attacks on transport ships in the Red Sea. How much of a danger is it to rely on these super vessels?
Well, proponents would say that they are just as efficient as other vessels, and in fact are better because you get more products on one vessel, so you rely on fewer vessels. But I think one aspect that is concerning is that who is it, which ports is it that can afford to accommodate these ULCVs? Because you need any port that receives such a large vessel needs to essentially rebuild and reconstruct itself to make space for it. And it's not just making space for the actual ship to fit in, it's having the cranes that can actually reach all these almost 25,000 containers. And that's a massive investment. And so who is it that can afford it? And I think what we risk seeing is that some ports will essentially become the ports of choice for global trade, and other ports, including ports in Western countries, won't be able to keep up. And it's no surprise that today China has the world's largest ports because there the government is able to invest in a much, much more generous way than Western governments are, because they have to be transparent with how they spend taxpayer money, and taxpayers have an opinion on it too. So what does that mean? I think if we may see some Western countries, some Western ports being left behind in this race.
Elizabeth Brough, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk now aviation. Greg Waldron is the Asia Managing Editor at Flight Global. He joins me on the line from Singapore. Hello, Greg.
Hey, good to be back again.
Thank you very much for coming back onto The Globalist. Now, just explain to us about Japan has lofty ambitions to build another airliner, or to build an airliner, I should say.
Yeah, so that was one of the really big stories in the last few days in the aviation space. You know, Japan put a lot of resources into an aircraft called the Mitsubishi Space Jet in the late 2000s. And then during the 2010s, they had a huge marketing campaign. They generated 300 orders, but they had a number of problems with that program. And eventually they ended up canceling it in 2023. So last week they came out with a blueprint where they're going to really, you know, work, really focus their industry on, you know, building up and like really kind of specializing in some very advanced technologies such as hydrogen propulsion and so forth, in the hopes that maybe in the 2030s, they can lead an international effort to develop an entirely new airliner, which is, you know, very ambitious and very interesting.
Why has Japan not succeeded at this in the past?
Well, Japan is very good at building aircraft, but the problem with the MRJ was that they were unable to really get it certified in the U.S. In a timely manner, and there was just other technical issues. It was a very high-quality aircraft by all accounts, but it was just kind of like the wrong timing. And also, too, there was changes in the market. Also, but traditionally, though, Japan has been a tier one supplier to the major airframers, specifically Boeing. And they've been very focused on, you know, wide-body aircraft, the 747, the 777, the 787, that kind of thing. And the problem now is that most airlines are buying, you know, narrow-body aircraft, especially airlines in Asia. So I think the Japanese government feels that Japan is kind of missing out on an opportunity in the narrow body space. So they want to work more into the narrow body space and ultimately move from being a tier one supplier to basically Boeing to being a original equipment manufacturer in their own right.
Let's move on to Europe. So stories coming from Air Malta. What's happening with them?
Yes, Air Malta is kind of interesting. They've basically have shifted over. They kind of went out of business on Saturday night. And on Sunday, a new entity was called KM Malta Airlines, which was announced last year, kind of took over and started operating their routes again. So basically, one airline kind of died and another airline was born. And what happened with the old Air Malta was that apparently over the years, there was a lot of government interference that gave them a very bloated workforce, gave them a very big wage bill. And, in the European airline market, which is characterized by these low-cost carriers, EasyJet, your Ryanairs, it's very difficult for these kind of small airlines to compete, especially when they have a very big cost base. It's really tough. And, of course, the Maltese government wanted to actually bail out Air Malta, but the EU put paid to that, and hence KM Malta Airlines was born.
Greg Waldron in Singapore, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, on today's programme, the plane Air Force One is one of the most recognisable emblems of the US presidency. Well, according to the White House website, at least, which says it's emblazoned with the words United States of America, the American flag and the seal of the President of the United States, an undeniable presence wherever it flies. It's also become the location of a considerable amount of petty theft. Journalists on presidential press junkets are now being asked to give back the stuff that may or may not have deliberately disappeared disappeared from the aircraft. There are reports that a discreet handover took place recently to enable a reporter to hand back an embroidered pillowcase because the White House has had enough of reporters helping themselves. Well, someone who would never do that is Nina Dos Santos, international broadcast correspondent and the former CNN Europe editor. She joins me on the line now. A very good morning to you, Nina. I am assuming that your carry-off luggage is innocently empty.
Oh, yeah. I'm a stickler for playing by the rules. And you know, when I read this story over the weekend as well, Emma, my eyebrows shot up because, full disclosure, I haven't been on Air Force One. I've been, to places like the White House and, you know, traveled with members of the White House traveling press corps in the past around Europe. But I had never actually witnessed this sort of theft. And it's amazing that these are the most coveted jobs in journalism in the world, and that anybody would risk them by bringing back a kind of personal memento. I think it's really quite surprising. You were talking about, how there was apparently this sort of furtive handover of an embroidered pillowcase. I was reading in one newspaper that apparently one very famous correspondent who was a sort of Washington veteran managed to serve whole dinner parties on crockery that had been half-inched over the course of their long career from, you know, Air Force One, and that this is sort of a bit of an inside joke. I've never actually deliberately nicked anything important. I did have one brush with this type of situation, which is when I went to go and film a feature show on Croatia joining the European Union in the summer of 2013. And as part of that, I went to go and do a big interview with the Prime Minister in Zagreb. And when I entered the room, I remember thinking, oh God, I've left my pen in my handbag in the antechamber and I can't go back and get it. There's a lovely pen on some paperwork on the desk. And I'm walking off with this sort of Faber-Castell rather expensive silver number. And I'm thinking, I can't use this. You know, it's obviously important. And it turned out, obviously, it was the Prime Minister's own personal pen to sign paperwork, probably including joining the EU itself. So it's a good job I actually put it back.
Indeed, your conscience allowed history to run its true course. We were just wondering, though, that to have that appeal by the White House to say, please give us back our pillowcases, it somehow comes across as a little bit mean. And one was wondering whether, you know, if you gave your reporters a goodie bag when they got onto Air Force One, they would be less tempted to steal the crockery.
Ah, I haven't thought about that. That's a really innovative solution. But I think also, Emma, you know, first of all, apparently they do sell memorabilia that is emblazoned with Air Force One, and, you know, the presidential seals, you know, all of that kind of memorabilia they do sell online. But apparently the point is it's actually slightly different. And connoisseurs in Washington would know the difference. I think this is the key thing. But I do think that this story speaks to something else that your previous guest was talking about, and that is the sort of unique airline culture, isn't it? You know, it's strange. You go to sort of cocktail parties around the world, don't you? And every now and then you come across something like a Lufthansa champagne glass, you know, in somebody's cupboard, and you think, why on earth would you take that? But, you know, there is a whole market for people who quite like half-inching something from 30,000 feet above the ground. It doesn't have its appeal to me, but I do recognise that with a lot of international travellers, perhaps it's their little frisson of doing something naughty. And obviously the ultimate is, inside Air Force One, slipping like an embroidered pillowcase into your handbag, if you like.
I wouldn't want
one of those George W. Bush bomber jackets, though. You know, because they're rather unfashionable.
What does it say about journalists?
Well, I think, you know, to lots of people who aren't journalists, this will paint them in a rather unpleasant light. And even I sort of swallowed hard when I read this because I thought, well, how on earth can anybody, if you're a reader and you're not a journalist and you don't get access to the President of the United States and you don't get access to Air Force One, how can you not realise this is a massive privilege? And that, you know, if you've got to be honest in your reporting, you should also be honest in terms of your, you know, behaviour and etiquette if you're on board these types of flights. Lots of people will be reading this and thinking, well, you know, hang on a second. Some of these journalists who are travelling with the president are writing about crime and punishment, jail sentences, you know, large amounts of, there's a lot of people who are stealing from shops, for instance, in the UK. We have reports every other day about, you know, massive amounts of shoplifting. And then here we have this privileged bunch of reporters traveling with the most powerful person in the world on a very luxurious and the most protected aircraft in the world, and they still think that it's cool to put something in your backpack or your handbag on the way out. And by the way, the security checks, as you can imagine, if you're getting off, you know, traveling with a prime minister or a president, the security checks aren't like what they are for your average person. You know, your passport gets taken aside, presumably it's all checked at once. They don't have the time, you know, when the president's on his busy schedule, to wait for 30 journalists to clear customs and have their bags searched, or, you know, for having taken something potentially, or having their passport checks done in the same way as your average person. So I think, yeah, lots of people will view this, and journalists who don't travel with the White House pool will view this and think, why on earth are these people feeling it's okay to take this stuff?
Nina,
they should really have a charity auction, by the way. Shouldn't they just have a charity auction at the White House Correspondents' Dinner every year and auction this type of stuff off to correspondents, and then they can raise money for a good cause, like perhaps supporting a free press?
Noble as ever. Nina Dos Santos, thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Vincent McAvinney, Carlotta Ribello and Tom Webb. Our researcher was Monica Lillis. Our studio manager was Christy O'Grady. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.